Shepherd and Corey Streisinger. Is it hearing or is it?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Peter Shepherd. I'm an Assistant Attorney General with the Oregon Department of Justice. I'm here to support House Bill 2282 on behalf of the Department of Justice and on behalf of Attorney General Dave Frohnmayer, who unfortunately could not attend this afternoon because he has flu. This bill is the single most important law change that this legislature can make to strengthen enforcement efforts in our fight against drugs. I urge this committee's approval of the bill and would invite a comment from Corey Streisinger, the governor's legal counsel.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Corey Streisinger, legal counsel to Governor Goldschmidt. I'm here to offer the governor's very strong support for this bill as well. I'd like to take a couple of minutes to discuss some of the background and in particular the relationship between this bill and House Joint Resolution 3, which I believe will be on the floor very shortly. Over the past few years, as I believe Mr. Shepherd mentioned, forfeiture has come to be an increasingly important tool for enforcement of our drug laws. Forfeiture can be used to seize the proceeds of drug transactions and also property which has been used to carry out the drug transactions. If the police stop a car on the highway, for example, and find a bag full of drugs and cash in the back seat, a forfeiture law can allow the cash to be confiscated through a civil court proceeding, not in criminal court, and in some cases may allow the car to be forfeited as well. At the moment, though, as you know, we do not have a statewide forfeiture statute in place that lets state officials do forfeitures in state courts. Instead, we have been making use of two different sets of procedures. First of all, several cities and counties have their own forfeiture ordinances, and we also participate in a federal program known as equitable sharing. And I need to ask Representative Calori's indulgence at this point because he has heard a great deal of this before in revenue and school finance. Under the equitable sharing program, which is a federal program in 21 U.S.C. Section 881E, the United States Attorney General is authorized to transfer an equitable share of forfeiture proceeds to the state or to local governments when those law enforcement agents participate in the acts leading to the forfeiture, so that if the state police do a forfeiture, for example, they can simply notify the FBI or the DEA. The property is then forfeited in federal court, frequently by Mr. Shepherd, who is cross-designated as an assistant U.S. attorney for that purpose, and a portion of it is shared back to the state. And that is how we fund a great deal of our state police narcotics enforcement efforts. This biennium, it's been $600,000. We are about to lose the federal equitable sharing procedure, however. At least we are about to lose it unless our Constitution is amended through HJR 3. The reason being that under the federal anti-drug bill passed at the end of the last Congress, an equitable share in forfeiture proceeds will no longer be available to a state that has a state law restriction on the way in which forfeiture proceeds are used. And our state constitution does have such a restriction in place. It devotes the forfeiture proceeds to the Common School Fund. That means we will lose the federal program and we will have, unless this House Bill 2282 passes, no state program in place with which to do forfeitures. So House Bill 2282 is a very important substitute for the federal program, which we are about to lose. Even if HJR 3 passes, and indeed even more if HJR 3 passes, this will be an extremely important tool for the enforcement of our narcotics laws. That is because under the federal program, we get only a share of the proceeds, sometimes 40%, sometimes 70%. Under our own forfeiture statute, where federal agents are not physically involved in the bust, we can take 100% for our own uses and divide it as we see fit. House Bill 2282 is important for another reason as well. As I mentioned a few moments ago, currently forfeitures are done in a number of cases under local city and county ordinances. The Court of Appeals, in a ruling a few weeks ago, held that those ordinances were not valid, not due to that constitutional restriction which I've referred to, but because of the structure of state law, which currently prohibits local jurisdictions from having forfeiture ordinances, at least in non-home rule jurisdictions, when the conduct which triggers the forfeiture is also a violation of state law. That obviously is a situation which can, and I believe should, be fixed by this body. House Bill 2282 would do that. It would replace state and local, local city and county forfeiture ordinances with a single uniform procedure that any jurisdiction could use, whether at the local or the state level. It would be simple, it would be efficient, and it would produce forfeiture revenues to support law enforcement activities. I'd like to mention briefly some proposed amendments, which I believe you have in front of you. As I mentioned, the Constitution does currently restrict the use of forfeiture proceeds by the state to the Common School Fund. It is an open question whether this constitutional restriction also applies to forfeitures by local governments. The amendments which we would propose deal with conforming House Bill 2282 to the proposed constitutional amendment, H.J.R. 3, and they include several sections that would go into effect if and only if H.J.R. 3 passes. The proposed amendments, and I should mention that some of the technical items in these amendments are still being discussed with the Attorney General's office and our office, so it may be that we will need to come back to you in a day or two with some minor changes. But the proposed amendments essentially provide that revenue produced by forfeitures can be used to reimburse the agency that does the forfeiture or that prosecutes the forfeiture, and the remainder ordinarily will go into a special fund which can then be used for law enforcement, prosecution, drug treatment, and drug education, therefore tying the proceeds of this forfeiture program to the general narcotics problem that is generating the forfeitures in the first instance. I'd be pleased to answer any questions about the amendments or about our position on the bill in general, and I'm sure Mr. Shepherd would as well.
Mr. Shepherd, yes.
Madam Chair, I'm prepared to give the committee an overview of generally of the issues involved that were addressed in House Bill 2282, if that would be helpful to the committee.
That would be very helpful.
And I came with visual aid even today.
House Bill 2282, as in its present form, is the result of more than a year of work by a group convened by the Judiciary Committee by Burton. The Forfeiture Working Group, as it was called, involved people who, many are potentially affected by forfeiture. I want to give the committee a little bit of background on some of the forfeiture issues, the issues arising in those discussions. Recognize those when you read House Bill 2282. The first set of issues have to do with the scope of a forfeiture scheme that can be created. The first question under that general topic is, do you create a forfeiture scheme which allows local jurisdictions to have their own forfeiture or not to have forfeiture as they may elect? Do you instead mandate a system which is applicable border to border across the state? House Bill 22 mandates a forfeiture system across the state border to border, that in counties which do not now have a ordinance by without one, they will have forfeiture. Second kind of scope question that was addressed and answered in what crimes or what conduct will constitute a basis for forfeiture, subjecting property to the process? And the answer in House Bill 2282 is generally that vice crimes, gambling, prostitution, bias offenses, are those offenses which will give rise to forfeiture under the bill. Now, there are other models for that. One of the local forfeiture ordinances applies forfeiture to every crime, be it a burglary or theft or type of crime. And there are models on the other side of it too. That is, there are models, for example, 21 section 81 for federal forfeiture provision, but it only applies by its terms in narcotics cases. The forfeiture working group chose sort of an intermediate ground and designated prostitution, gambling, and narcotics. theory behind that was those are traditionally associated with crimes for profit, generate assets. And next kind of question that was addressed and answered to some extent in House Bill 2280, question of proportionality. Here, the issue is, do you forfeit a $25,000 or spend because it has only a small quantity of cocaine in it? In other words, ought there be some connection between the perceived severity of the offense giving rise to the forfeiture that suffered? And the answer generally in House Bill 2282 is that drugs are poison. Have drugs and use them as cocaine or property in connection with those drugs in a prohibited manner, that the whole property is going to be subject to forfeiture. Now, there are some limitations to that in House Bill 2282, and the principal ones have to do with marijuana. Possession or conspiracy to possess less than 1 ounce of marijuana will not give rise to case. Mercedes-Benz automobile had less than an ounce of marijuana in it, then that would not be an offense that would give rise to forfeiture. Likewise, drug proceeds of the sale, or the property used to facilitate the delivery of less than 5 grams of marijuana, not give rise to forfeiture. There are some proportionality requirements built into the bill, but by and large, the answer to that question is no. In terms of the procedure that was adopted, the first choice that the working group made was to select a civil forfeiture procedure. A variety of reasons for this, the principal one being that that is the most efficacious manner in which to secure assets. There are obvious advantages to proceeding in a civil form as opposed to a criminal form. In addition to that, there's a potential constitutional problem under the Oregon. Because the Oregon Constitution provides that a criminal conviction does not give rise to a forfeiture of estate. And so that has the potential, if one were to make these forfeitures linked directly to a criminal conviction, to subject that forfeiture to that provision of it. And so we follow the civil forfeiture model, which is a model that has at least 250 years of heritage. Common law was adopted as a remedy for customs violations by the first United States Congress and has been part of the law of the United States ever since and other states. I might add that I reviewed all 50 states in the course of preparing one of the drafts of House Bill 2280, and that the majority have civil forfeiture proceedings, at least. Second kind of procedural question that was addressed was, what is the authority of a police officer to make a seizure for forfeiture? The bill specifies that the police officer may make a seizure for forfeiture if he may constitutionally do so. And the reason that that's a significant provision in the bill is that that frees the police officer from the intricacies of Oregon statutory search and seizure law. This committee has had occasion to address one of those statutory provisions, the stop provision. And you may recall the testimony there that the Oregon stop statute presently extends more protection in the area of search and seizure than does the United States Constitution. And under the provisions of House Bill 2282, a forfeiture could be maintained even if the stop was not valid. Officers obviously constrained by the Oregon and the United States Constitution, so that if an unlawful, unconstitutional stop were made,
Representative Mr. Shepherd, Representative Mason has a question.
Maybe, well, I did forfeiture law, is a little bit different. My understanding was that at least defended a very large boat once, that it didn't matter that this boat was allegedly caught with a ton of marijuana on it. The theory was that the individual had not offended, this goes way back, the theory was that the individual had not offended the king, but that the instrumentality had offended the king. And you were not picking on an individual, you were sticking on the instrumentality, and instrumentalities don't have constitutional rights.
Madam Chair, Representative Mason, that is a correct statement of the theory of in rem forfeiture actions. The theory is that the property itself has a... The problem is that the United States Supreme Court and several of the circuit courts have held that the proceeding has enough of personal character that the search and seizure provision will apply to the suppression of evidence.
Has this been recently? Recently, I remember I did a lot of work, and this was 10 years ago when I did.
Madam Chair, Representative, there are cases of fairly recent vintage, yes, that hold that. The tricky part is, though, that, and the bill provides for this as well, that the forfeiture may be maintained even though, but let us say that the person obtains an order of the court that indicates. Ruling of the court that indicates that the seizure was unconstitutional. The rule in forfeiture cases, House Bill 2282, that does not necessarily require turning the property back to the defendant. Instead, you look to see whether, independent of the constitutional violation, there is sufficient material to support a finding of the property subject to forfeiture. And so, in your boat case, you may have successfully defended your boat, but not so. Well, apparently the government had, independent of any constitutional violation, sufficient evidence to support it. This bill provides for that as well. So that even if the court found that unconstitutionally obtained evidence was part of the government's case, if the balance supported forfeiture, the forfeiture could be seized.
So there's no fruit from the poisonous tree type operation in there?
By statute, Representative Mason, by House Bill 2282, in effect, the fruit of the poisonous tree rule is adopted. So that if it's tainted by the unconstitutional seizure, you cannot maintain the forfeiture. But if you have independent evidence of the illegal use, then you may.
Well, it is, although do we really have to give up that much? I mean.
Madam Chairman, Representative Mason, whether you want to give up that much, I guess, is a policy question. That is what the bill does. And my understanding is that it accurately reflects the case law now that applies in the forfeiture arena. Let me address then the third kind of procedural issue, and that is do we adopt the forfeiture model which allows for administrative forfeiture, as the federal system does. That's an important choice because in the federal system, a great many of these cases proceed by administrative forfeiture. And something over 80% of those cases are uncontested. What that means is you have a very efficient system. It doesn't involve lawyers, it doesn't involve judges. It's simply the agency preparing the notices of proposed forfeiture, hearing the forfeiture. Now, we departed from the federal model a little bit in House Bill 2282, in that even in the administrative forfeiture process, under House Bill 2282, we require the agency to go to a court at the end of that process and obtain a judgment of the court, so that there is some judicial scrutiny of that administrative process. The fourth kind of procedural question that we asked and answered in House Bill 2282, where do the burdens of persuasion and the burdens of coming forward rest? Bill, follow the federal model here as well. In the federal system, the burden of coming forward with probable cause to believe that the property is subject to forfeiture rests on the government. Once that burden is satisfied, claimant claiming the property should be returned has the burden of persuasion to demonstrate by a preponderance that the property is not subject to forfeiture. This is federal law and is adopted in House Bill 2282. The fifth question that we asked and answered regarding the procedure of forfeiture has a doctrine that's called the relation back doctrine. This simply provides that have really three choices as to when the government's interest in property. First one is when the illegal act occurs. Second one is when the seizure occurs. Third one is when the judgment of the court issues forfeiture of property. This bill, like the federal law, adopts the relation back doctrine, which says that the government's interest attaches when the property is illegally used or illegally acquired. Acquired, that is, in the The next area of questions that were asked and answered in this, how are innocent owners to be protected from the potentially very harsh applications of burden and relation back doctrine? And the answer to that is that House Bill 2282 provides more protections than does the federal law. Unlike the federal law, we have provided in House Bill 2282 a mechanism for protecting the interests of financial institutions. It's a long list of people, but you might think of them generally as banks or security interest holders in property. They were particularly concerned about the relation back doctrine because it raised the possibility that the government would have an interest in the property which had not yet matured by seizure, by judgment of forfeiture, and therefore would undermine the security of what the financial institution thought it was taking free and clear as collateral. So we provided a mechanism in the bill for weeding out those claims and protecting them. And I think that the for that mechanism. The second area that we were concerned about in drafting House Bill 2282 was protecting individual owners. And here we, again, unlike the federal statute, we provided an across-the-board affirmative defense for individuals who you might think of for in terms of shorthand reference as bona fide purchasers, people who acquired their interest in the property without knowledge and without being in any way involved in the underlying agreement. Now, the final thing that we discussed in the working group and had quite a lot of discussion about is the question of how do you distribute the assets once they're forfeited. And here the legal constraints are relatively simple. Kreisinger has already referred to the Oregon constitutional provision regarding the common school funds. That complicated significantly our efforts to draft a mechanism for distributing assets upon forfeiture. And as she also indicated, we are still in the process of attempting to work that out with some kind of a formula that makes sense and operates well. I should say that the present draft, House Bill 2282, as far as it refers to Oregon, is not well drafted and does need some operating properly. I can give the committee a brief walk through House Bill 2282. It's a complicated piece of legislation, but the truth is that in operation, I think it'll prove to be fairly there are two ways that a police officer or a government can seize property under the bill. First way is with a court order. Anticipated that court order would be akin to search warrant in that the police officer or the seizing agency would submit an affidavit under oath to the court that justified why the police officer or agency wanted to seize that property and why they thought they had probable cause to do so.
Mr. Shepard, just a second. You say it is assumed that would be the procedure?
That is the procedure in the bill. I say assumed because we borrow some from the mechanism for the mechanism for issuing search warrants. And in the event there's any question about how you go about this, a good guide would be to look at the mechanism for search warrants. But it is spelled out in the bill.
Okay, I just don't want to leave any of this up to assumption. So you're flagging some places. It's not that you're assuming that that's what the bill says,
no.
But that is what the bill says.
That is what the bill says, and for additional guidance on how it would operate, so that people could look in the future, search warrants. That order could, in fact, be endorsed on the face of a search warrant, so that the police officer could not only obtain the search warrant for directing the seizure evidence of a criminal offense, but the same document would contain an endorsement authorizing the seizure of the proceeds of the criminal activity or other things which are subject to forfeiture under the bill. Alternatively, the police officer could obtain such an order independent of a search warrant and separate from the search warrant. The other alternative, obviously, is that the police officer may seize property without such an order. I've already discussed a little bit about the choices that we that area, and basically, the police officer has as much authority as the Constitution allows to make it. The the procedure then diverges according to whether this is real property or property which is subject to a security interest. If the property is not real property or and is not subject to a security interest, then the administrative forfeiture remedy is an option available to the forfeiture agency. Basically, that commences with the agency publishing notice of the proposed forfeiture and serving notice on all persons known to have an interest in that property. After that publication is completed, then claims were filed by any person to that property, then the forfeiting agency would have to turn the matter over to their forfeiture counsel. At that point forward, if no claim were filed, the agency would prepare an affidavit stating who they had served and what steps they had taken to serve after a court. And on the basis of that affidavit, the court would issue a judgment. There is a proposed amendment attached to my materials that pertains to this step of the process, the step involving publication by the local agency. And the problem here is that in some cases, in fact, in some jurisdictions, in many cases, there are seizures taking place which are under $1,000. Say $750 from the pocket of a drug dealer on Portland Road here in Salem. The difficulty with requiring publication as it is in the present draft of House Bill 2282 in all such cases is that the publication is the same kind of publication required under the Illinois Rules of Civil Procedure, which is 4 weeks of consecutive publication. That very quickly eats up the $750 seizure. And so one of the proposed amendments attached to my materials would provide that the local jurisdiction may, but is not required, publish notice in cases involving cash less than $1,000. Only in those category of cases. All other categories of cases would be required.
Question? What's, I see why you're doing that. That doesn't satisfy me much from the standpoint of whatever processes due, whatever owner there might be out there. If I'm an Oregon appellate court trying to strike the statute down, I'm not satisfied that because it's going to eat up your money. Does that do it? That satisfy due process?
Madam Chair, Representative Clark, I think you raised a good question. And if I were counsel for one of those jurisdictions, I would say the safe thing to do is publish. And the reason is not that we would be able to protect the judgment we got against collateral attack. I think, though, that there's sufficient doubt about whether publication is required. That's a choice that local counsel perhaps should be permitted to make on behalf of their agency. So I think you raised an excellent question, and that is indeed the challenge that we asserted at a subsequent collateral attack. But I don't know that I'm so certain about the answer to force that choice upon local jurisdictions in those small category of cases.
Go ahead.
In terms of the judicial forfeiture process, it begins much like any other civil proceeding, and in fact, it can be bill provides that the rules of civil procedure do apply to these provisions to this act. And that would include, of course, the rules of discovery. And it begins with the filing of a complaint. And here, there is some difference to the usual case, and that is this is a complaint in rem. Again, the theory is that the property itself is defendant. So the action is the state of Oregon versus one Motor Yacht. Oregon versus one 1972 Chevrolet Corvette. Again, there is a notice requirement. And then after the notice is given to a person known to have an interest, the required response on the part of an individual makes a claim to the property. It consists of three things. First, of a claim. And in the claim, the person states with some specificity why they believe that this property is not subject to forfeiture. The second thing that's required is a bond. And the bond is 10% cash bond, and 10% of the value of the property. The third thing that is required is an answer. Now, all of these things are required in the federal system, and the requirement that all three of these things be filed in response to a complaint has indeed served in the federal system to weed out frivolous claims, to weed out the offender who simply wants to impair and raise the cost of forfeiture by filing an answer which is best marginal and often frivolous. In fact, these requirements have served to weed those claims out of the federal system. The Oregon Constitution will require a jury trial. We have a case from an old forfeiture case in Oregon that arose under the existing vehicle forfeiture statute that so provided. So in Oregon, we are going to have jury trials on this question. Now, I referred a little bit ago to the fast track for financial institutions. And basically what it consists of is the filing by the financial institution of an affidavit with the court after the complaint has been filed, which states what the interest of the financial institution is, the terms under which they acquired it, and